We extend to you an invitation to learning.
An invitation to join three guests as they discuss great books. When our guests of today were in school, every student had to read Cicero's Orations in Latin. The educated men who wrote the United States Constitution read Cicero, too. Many of them were familiar with one of the great Roman orator's essays called The Offices, an essay that combined Stoic ideas of personal good with the Roman ideal of civic virtue. De Officiis, or The Offices, by Marcus Tullius Cicero, is the subject of Invitation to Learning today. Chairman of the discussion is Lyman Bryson. His guests are John N. Schuster, president of Hunter College and newly appointed state commissioner for Bavaria, and Erwin Edman, professor of philosophy at Columbia University and author of Fountainheads of Freedom. For Invitation to Learning's discussion of Cicero's De Officiis, we hear first from Lyman Bryson.
We did have to read Cicero's Orations when we were all in school. And I remember being at that time very much interested in oratory, that the great man's skill and persuasiveness and sonority shone through even the rather difficult Latin, because all Latin was difficult for me. Of course, it probably was very easy for you, too. I rather liked Cicero. I don't remember reading The Offices, or Of Moral Duties, as it has been called. But I know that the people who started this country read it and probably got out of it a kind of an ideal, a kind of total ideal of behavior.
Yes, Bryson, I think they did. I remember reading parts of it as a boy and finding them very difficult.
But now, wait a minute, Mr. Schuster. You don't mean that you went off and read them for pleasure? The way I read Dick Merriwell or something like that.
No, I did them out of a sense of duty. And I must confess, not moral duty, but pure, sheer scholastic duty. But rereading the book again, I found it really very interesting. It's done in the form of letters written to his son, who was then supposedly studying philosophy in Athens, written because Cicero, who had been a great and successful lawyer, a member of the Roman Senate, and a statesman of some influence, had fallen on relatively evil days and was compelled to live in exile somewhat sumptuously on one of his estates.
Rather disapproving of Caesar, who had taken over.
Decidedly so, and also more particularly, later on, of Caesar's successors and of the inability to reestablish the Republic.
Well, as long as our school days and Cicero's influence on it have been mentioned, I would like to say that for a long time I was under the impression that Cicero had spent his life delivering orations against Catiline, and that he was a very able, eloquent lawyer and special pleader and a political prosecutor on a very high level. And what impressed me on rereading this book, what impressed me when I first read it later in college and not in school, was that here you had an extremely cultivated, civilized, philosophical gentleman who, like just as a great many Americans, were brought up on European philosophy, had as a Roman been brought up on Greek philosophy.
And was Mr. Edmund a very great mediator of the Greek ideal to the Romans, wasn't he? I know one American philosopher, Wenley, says that this was the single mind that had most to do with interpreting Greek philosophy to the Roman greatness.
And one may say he had an extremely hard job doing it, in one sense, because he was trying to make a speculative, detached, disinterested urbanity of the Greeks appeal to an extremely practical-minded people.
Yes, and perhaps he was more successful with his with the generations that followed him than he was with his own time, because this book became a sort of seed from which the thinking about government, and in particular the education of princes, took its rise in subsequent generations. Petrarch's book about the education of princes comes right out of De Officiis. And then we have the subsequent ones, which take us pretty far through the 17th century into our time.
Well, you're saying that the Stoic ideal, which Cicero believed in and tried hard to live by, tried to explain and make persuasive to the Romans, has persisted right down through the Christianity, which came right after Cicero, as one of the elements of the moral ideals of European peoples.
Precisely, and I remember that a very pleasant day on which we talked about the Epistle to St. Paul. And if we recall the phrase, live honestly, soberly, and justly, well, then we have in Paul an echo, a reverberation of the Stoic thinking that finds itself put into this book. So
a little more passion in Paul than Cicero would have approved of, I think, probably.
Oh, yes. Much deeper,
well,
fervor.
Well, doesn't that come from the fact that this book, besides being a source book and a seed book, if that's not mixing the metaphors, of governmental ideas in the whole Western tradition of law, and one might say democracy, also is in another class of books that you cannot help thinking of as you read and or reread it. And that is a book on not the education of a prince, but on the education of a gentleman. Part of this book is on public duties, some of it on private opportunities and responsibilities for leading a full and, as Cicero makes so clear, an orderly life. It belongs with a book like Chesterfield, as a device at least, is addressed to Cicero's son studying philosophy in Greece and reminding his father of the days when he studied philosophy.
I think it even had some influence on the education of women, because it occurs to me that possibly when Thomas More was plotting out the kind of intellectual program that could be devised for his daughters, and therewith for the educated English girl, that he may very well have derived some of his insight from this very book.
Of course, long before your time, perhaps not so long before your time, Dr. Schuster, they stopped educating women into good English gentlemen and started educating them into something else. Wasn't there perhaps an idea here that if this ideal was good enough for men, it was good enough for women, too?
It certainly was, insofar as the Elizabethans were concerned.
But it is certainly primarily a book addressed to the education of a gentleman. I'm reminded of the fact that Anthony Trollope once said this book by Cicero is really a book by a pagan Christian. He also might have said by a pagan Englishman.
All right, now, Mr. Edmund, what did he want people? What did he want his son to believe in? What is this Stoic ideal that he gave his son?
Well, the Stoic ideal, which incidentally, with any claims one may make for Cicero as a great master of the Latin language, a claim which he quite properly makes for himself in the beginning of this book, his ideal was, as he frankly says, derivative. He borrowed it from earlier Stoic philosophy, but he's quite clear about the points that he thinks constitute the contours, one might say, of the education of a gentleman. There are four points that concern the life of a well-rounded, responsible citizen of the world. One is connected with the discovery of the truth. A man must know what the nature of things is in order to be able to act wisely.
That one must have shocked the Romans just a little bit as being not very practical, don't you think? That has a Greek sound to it, the love of truth as a first virtue.
Well, except that Cicero himself, who was pretty practical-minded rather than speculative philosopher, is almost a pragmatist on that point. You need to know as much of nature as is useful to you in solving these other problems. Matter of fact, he would have been just as contemptuous as other Romans, about knowledge for its own sake or a vision of all eternity. That wasn't, I think, his line. But if you did have
truth with a small t, perhaps. A pragmatic, useful truth.
Truth with a small t about nature with a capital N, perhaps we could.
And also about human nature.
And about humanness. That is really a knowledge of the world, really.
All right, now I diverted you, Mr. Edmund. What are the other three points? I'm sorry.
I tried to divert you by my reply, Mr. Bryson. The other three points, one, those concerned with the preservation of society. If you were involved in the world, you were not involved in it alone. You were involved with other people. And Cicero makes a great deal of that point. There's nothing artificial about society. It's right in the nature of things and the nature of human nature to have relations of fellowship with other people, and there are certain problems of the preservation of civil society come.
And problems of the relationship between the civil law and the underlying general law.
Yes, that there is a point, and this comes out perhaps more explicitly in Cicero's other works, including the one on the Commonwealth, but it's suggested here that there are points at which what looks like reasonable law in society turns out to be a distortion and a perversion of natural law, and that the laws of society must always be referred back to what really is natural, reasonable, and just at the foundation of real justice is not in society, but in nature.
Then we've got truth and the public interest. Those are two.
And then a term that is awfully hard, I think, to not to make rather pompous sounding in Cicero. I think he has something genuinely noble at the heart of it, and not simply pompous. The term that's translated, greatness of soul. And I take it what Cicero meant by that that anyone who lived up to truly human, or what one may call humane stature, had to have a certain kind of disinterestedness, or what Aristotle would have called magnanimity of spirit.
Yes, I would say a steadfast and unpurchasable soul.
And you would say very well indeed, Mr. Schuster.
Has a Ciceronian sound, Mr. Schuster. A steadfast and unpurchasable soul.
As a matter of fact, wasn't that, Mr. Bryson? Didn't that come out of some bitternesses of Cicero's own career, where he saw himself surrounded by corruption and saw that in political life there was a good deal of purchasable and unsteady?
I was beginning to wonder, Mr. Edmund, why we ignored completely, or more than ignored except for a passing reference, the fact that this was an old man who had seen the republic that he had served and in which he believed with a great deal of depth, of emotion, if not of actual active passion, taken over by a man whom he had once been an acquaintance of, a political opponent of, in a sense that I'm quite sure he would have said just a simple dictatorship. Julius Caesar had taken over the old Rome that Cicero believed in, that he had hoped his son could one time be a great man in, was gone. There is a kind of struggle against bitterness here.
Yes, and one of the moving things about the book, Bryson, I think, is the reminiscence that's in it. The continuous effort to recall the greatness of former days, to bring to the reader's attention those episodes in Roman intellectual and political history that one could look back upon with pride.
But he doesn't ever say the old day is gone.
No.
He doesn't say to his son, there's no use trying to be the kind of man that I was.
Oh, no, no. He says always, we must attempt to make the immortal Rome the Rome of justice as it was reflected in its history.
And he doesn't mean the Rome in heaven either. He means the immortal Rome on earth.
Yes, therein he differs from his disciple Augustine, who learned Greek philosophy from Cicero, who, of course, decided that it was impossible to have this kind of Rome on earth, and therefore it would have to be in heaven.
Well, at the risk of sounding schoolmasterish or schoolboyish, Mr. Bryson, don't think we ought to forget the fourth point he makes at the very beginning, which is that all this ultimately has to do, and any program for life or consideration of its duties, is in one way or another a variation on the theme of orderliness in the soul, which is a reflection based upon knowledge of the order of nature. Wouldn't you say that is the heart of the thing, Mr. Schuster?
I think, Edmund, that Cicero has in the back of his mind a sort of picture of a stormy landscape and a landscape that is serene and tranquil, in which life can go on at an even pace. The storms of society are produced by passions, which in turn are engendered by the false quest for pleasure, what he calls expediency. And the real life is the life that is led in accordance with those principles which can produce a sort of sane and measured pace of things. I think there's a little danger lest sometimes this might be just a bit complacent, just a bit too conservative, just a bit too conservative, just a bit too legal.
Isn't not hypocritical, though.
Oh, no, it's very sincere.
Isn't it a little bit, if I may introduce an ad hoc argument, and you'll forgive the introduction of a Latin phrase and talking about Cicero, Schuster, isn't it a little bit the way a college president might feel about wanting an orderly going on? I once heard a college president, not you, Mr. Schuster, say, my job is to keep this college going and keep it in order.
I think, Edmund, I may reply by saying that most college presidents I know agree with Augustine that that kind of universe can be hoped for only off the campus.
Well, as a matter of fact...
You mean to say that the Roman Empire that came between Cicero and Augustine proved that it wouldn't work on earth, and since then we've sought order and stability and justice and great souls only in heaven?
No, but I merely made the point that that most of us who are in the unfortunate position of dealing with members of the faculties, particularly with philosophers, are not eager to establish mere order. What we really want is a continuous torrent of creativity.
Well, we're delighted to provide that, Mr. President, but I think Cicero did actually believe that if you had order in the individual soul based upon a conformity with nature, the order of nature as understood, you could have, in the very highest sense, an imperium or empire of order, that would really provide a pattern of life, and that's what he was trying to tell his son about.
Yes, but now I would like to know what is wrong with this Stoic ideal. It didn't suit the Romans. The whole course of history for the next 400, 500 years, although it came back, of course, in Marcus Aurelius and the Antonines, came back to this ideal, but this very stormy period when Julius Caesar took over and Augustus followed him and the first emperors were building Rome, the imperial Rome, this creativity, which you say presidents of colleges, Mr. Schuster, and other dispensers of justice and freedom believe in, why was it the Romans, did they abandon the Stoic ideal in this turbulent and creative period?
Bryson, I think that you can find part of the answer in the simple circumstance that the great majority of people did not see in the laws that were presented to them, that is, the actual incorporation of law in the state, anything that resembled this kind of ulterior ideal that Cicero had in mind. The people were always face to face with the fact that the law was an imperfect thing, that it gave justice to somebody else and not to them. And you had the modern phenomenon of a collective sense of injustice, which is the secret frustration from which so many states have suffered in our time.
Doesn't Cicero, as a matter of fact, say one of the troubles is that people tend to interpret justice not in the sense of a possible universal order, but in terms of what seems to them what they want, what is really their pleasure? And he inveighs in the same way as somebody might inveigh against a welfare state as giving too much to everybody. We must be careful to respect the rights of private property. We must be careful not to interfere with the order of things. He is, in that sense, what we familiarly call a conservative in politics. There's no question about that.
Yes, Edmund, he says that we ought to treat our slaves as if they were employees, but there certainly is no doctrine of labor relations in this book.
No, but for a Roman of his time, Mr. Schuster, he was rather a humanitarian. I mean, this was a little Greek gentleness coming into the Roman brutality, wasn't it? But there's something deeper here that bothers me. Is there a basic falsity in this book? I don't mean in the character of Cicero, whose sincerity I'm taking for granted, but that Cicero says, on the one hand, let's make a good society, but on the other hand, he, shall we say, pretends to be a Stoic who didn't believe, I mean, basically, Stoic philosophy doesn't to put any faith in man's efforts. There's no use really trying to do anything. You go through the... It always seemed to me that Stoicism has a poison at its root in that sense. I don't mean as morals, but as a program of action, because you don't believe that what you do will do any good.
Well, not quite. I don't think that's quite fair.
Well, I'm sure it isn't. I'm overstating it. But now, what?
I think the point is, it is true that most Stoics say, as Marcus Aurelius did, don't. Not a question of winning the game. You just play the game. If you're a slave, you must play well the part of a slave. If you're an emperor, you must play well the part of an emperor. If you're a public man in any way, you must act with disinterestedness and magnanimity. I always get the impression that Cicero's conception of a public official was that the more high-minded British officials in India in the 19th century. They thought the thing was relatively hopeless, but you must do the very best you could.
The 19th century, Mr. Edmund. Those are not the Englishmen who made the British Empire.
No, that's true.
They're the people that took it over and more or less let it go from their fingers.
Mr. Bryson, I think the point that you were making might be illustrated this way. Chesterton has a line which reads, he who's lost his laughter when he counts the wager worth. That's from Lepanto. I think the Stoic is a man who is quite willing to lose, but never to laugh. And that there's this curious substructure of fatalistic seriousness in Stoicism, from my point of view.
Of gravity and responsibility, a grave sense of responsibility.
Yes.
And on the whole, that the order of nature, the curious paradox in Stoicism, the order of nature is always orderly below all the confusions of society. But it was your job to find out what the order of nature was, what your own nature was, and how to conform with the nature of things. And if you did, you wouldn't help nature to be more orderly, but you would be, in a sense, carrying out in your segment of the universe what constituted reason.
Perhaps their most distinguished contribution was their writing of civil law, which incorporated some of their principles and some of their points of view.
Again, a stabilizer, Mr. Schuster.
But suppose you take that illustration that Cicero is fond of adducing, namely the introduction of the statutes against fraud, which perhaps as great a contribution to Roman law as any other, and which, of course, grows right out of their thinking about the primacy of integrity, the primacy of the moral principle, as opposed to any kind of expediency or mere pleasure.
What did our people, our forefathers, Mr. Schuster, take out of this book? Was it an ideal of gentlemanly behavior? Was it a stoicism, a willingness to play the game with no hope of winning but still play it?
I think it was a sense of, I may answer for Mr. Schuster for a moment, I think it was a sense of equity that was supposed to be a function of the universal order in nature itself, that justice, morally and politically, as opposed to fraud and expediency, was really in the nature of things, which was somehow perverted and violated when you had fraud.
That's a profoundly religious judgment, Mr. Edmund.
Well, I think when Anthony Trollope called Cicero a pagan Christian, that's one of the things he had in mind.
I agree with you, Edmund. Seems to me that for our ancestors, particularly in Britain, the association of a Christian faith, such as they would find in the New Testament, with a Roman philosopher so cognate in many respects, presented a doctrine, a program of moral action as an integral part of a society which is still with us, because I think that the average American continues to believe that a moral principle must somehow be embedded both in foreign policy and in domestic policy.
Well, I think also in England, for example, at the present time, there's apparently a current phrase, fair shares for all. And I think if you universalize that in Cicero's sense of a really universal society, where he said all means not simply people of your group or nation, but all mankind, that notion animated the makers of the American Constitution, of the founders of British civil liberty. But right, we're thinking, Mr. Bryce, that we're making a kind of purely political treatise of this, and there's a whole side of this book, and I think not the least attractive side, though a little of it reads like Polonius. It's really concerned with not the public obligations of a gentleman, but his private obligations and duties, including those of being a host, how to be a good host, how to behave properly in the world, and I think maybe we ought
how to be amusing without making yourself too ridiculous beneath a gentleman.
Exactly.
How to conduct your commercial affairs in such a manner that your friends will still continue to be your friends.
Well, now, most of these books written when a man is in retirement, most of these books written as a kind of disappointed response to life, have in them a very large measure of either of disillusionment or of a sort of unquenchable aspiration that a man reasserts in the face of his destiny. Was Cicero whistling in the dark here? Did in other words, is he saying this is what I wish might have been true, as so many other men have written at the ends of their Boethius, for instance, who writes about the same kind of philosophy when he's in prison about to be executed. Cicero more or less knew that his time was only too short. Is it he really means it, does he, practically?
Yes, I didn't find that disillusionment in the book at all.
Not at all, to my mind.
His faith is firm still.
Yes, I think that he regards the law as something that can really produce a great deal of benefit for men if you only give it a chance.
And he thinks there may be temporary corruptions and obfuscations, but given a chance that the order of nature can become an order in society, too. I think that's very unlike belief here.
What does he say today, Mr. Edmund?
Well, I think...
What does he say to us? Not as ex-schoolboys reading Cicero, but men reading a book.
I think he says several important things that have become curiously and acutely timely again. One is the accent on the fact that we are, in a profound sense, both gregarious and rational brothers, that we are members of a universal society, that there can be one world, that there are principles that transcend the confusions, the corruptions, and the contingencies of our present society, that in the midst of panic, we can be reasonable men.
Does this have a modern sound, Mr. Edmund? This is from the second book. Others there are who are ready to confess that they ought to bear such a regard, that is, of generosity and justice, to fellow citizens, but by no means allow of it in relation to strangers. Now these men destroy that universal society of all mankind, which, if once taken away, kindness, liberality, justice, and humanity must utterly perish.
I think Prigville Lee would like to read that aloud to a good many people.
I found particularly helpful these passages in which he discusses the laws which govern the conduct of war, which I think were rediscovered by Wellington during the period of Napoleon, acquired by him somehow at Saint-Cyr, and reintroduced into our thinking about war and peace, because the major principle was that you must think about the peace while you are conducting the war, and the peace must somehow be just.
It's not war on principle, but peace on principle. Peace and war as an instrument.
When Grant said to Lee, take your horses home, you'll need them from the spring plowing, I think he's echoing Cicero and old Roman law.
Well, that one other impression I think we ought to take from this book. Cicero speaks to us as a great artist when, in the beginning of the book, he tells his son, whether you learn philosophy from this book or not, and it's not my own philosophy, what you will learn is the use of the Latin language. And this book still speaks to us as a work of art by a very serious, minded, gravely responsible Roman citizen.
The subject of today's program was Cicero's De Officiis. Chairman Lyman Bryson had as his guests George N. Schuster and Irwin Edmund. Next week, Invitation to Learning celebrates its 10th anniversary broadcast with an examination of the Constitution of the United States, the same subject as that of the first broadcast in May 1940. Lyman Bryson will be joined in the discussion by Senator Robert A. Taft and Senator Paul H. Douglas.
Invitation to Learning is a presentation of the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.